desired chemical composition. After completing the Sol-Gel process, the next step is drying to obtain the target powder. Subsequently, to achieve the intended structural properties, biocompatibility, and a specific characteristic termed PATEL, the synthesized powder undergoes heat treatment at a controlled temperature. Following this, the sample is milled, and the insert process, a term used for spheroidization, is performed to shape the particles into spheres. Once spheroidization is complete, the particles are spherical, but exhibit a broad size distribution, ranging from approximately 15 to 20 micrometers. However, the final product requires particles between 10 to 20 micrometers. To achieve this, we perform particle size classification using mechanical sieving, mechanical screening. After sieving, quality control, QC, is conducted under a microscope. The particles are then sterilized, packaged into specialized vials, and sent for irradiation.
These microspheres, these tiny glass beads that contain yttrium 90, they need to be a very specific size, between 20 to 40, 50 microns, so basically thinner than a hair strand. And they need to be exactly that size, or exactly within that range, because if they are too small, then they could essentially seep into other organs of the body. If they are too big, they will just get lodged into the main vessel that is going into the liver. So it needs to be, the size needs to be just right. So once they are injected, they'll essentially lodge themselves around the area where the cancer tumor is getting fed from the blood supply. And they start emitting beta rays that start to shrink the cancer tumor by destroying the DNA of the cancer tumor. And that way, it'll gradually shrink down and get replaced by healthy cells to the point that we can hopefully say that the cancer tumor is essentially gone. And it's compared to the typical external radiation methods, you know, you have to do multiple hospital visits, whereas this is a one-time injection, which is also a lot more precise, hence the selective internal radiation therapy, SIRT. So we're going to take a closer look at how this process works first, and then talk about the broader implications of it.
The patient is first prepared with mild sedation and local anesthesia at the groin. A small incision is made to allow insertion of a catheter into the femoral artery. Using real-time imaging, the catheter is carefully navigated through the arterial network until it reaches the hepatic artery, the main vessel supplying the liver. At this point, a carefully measured suspension of yttrium 90 loaded glass microspheres is injected directly into the hepatic artery. These microspheres, each between 20 and 50 microns in diameter, travel with the bloodstream until they lodge in the tiny arterioles feeding the tumor. Their small size ensures that they preferentially accumulate in the tumor's vascular bed while bypassing much of the healthy tissue. Once the microspheres are in place, they begin to emit beta radiation. This form of radiation penetrates only a few millimeters, targeting the tumor cells while largely sparing the surrounding healthy liver tissue. The beta particles disrupt the DNA within cancer cells, impairing their ability to divide and triggering cell death. This localized radiation gradually shrinks the tumor over several days, as the continuous emission of energy damages the cancer cell's structural integrity. The entire injection process typically takes between 60 to 90 minutes. In the days following the treatment, the microspheres continue to emit radiation, steadily damaging the tumor from within. Throughout this process, the targeted nature of the therapy minimizes systemic side effects typically seen with the traditional chemotherapy or external radiation. By concentrating the therapeutic effects directly at the tumor site, normal liver function is largely preserved, and patients often experience a significant improvement in their quality of life. The precision of this treatment reduces complications and supports a quicker recovery, allowing patients to resume their normal activities sooner. This method represents a significant advance in the treatment of liver cancer, offering a minimally invasive alternative that delivers high doses of radiation directly to the tumor while minimizing exposure to healthy tissues.
It is important to note that the yttrium or Newell glass microspheres injected into patients are biocompatible. The particle size for these microspheres is within the 40 to 50 micron range. Particles smaller than 50 microns risk passing through hepatic capillaries and leaking into the lungs. Particles larger than 50 microns avoid this issue, as they do not migrate from blood vessels into the liver mass. Due to these critical size-dependent effects, strict quality control, QC testing, is performed on the particles to ensure their size falls within the specified range.
The yttrium glass microspheres discussed here are not our primary focus. However, they represent the latest achievement of the radiotherapy equipment research laboratories at the Nuclear Science and Technology Research Institute and are classified as medical devices. This technology serves as a non-surgical alternative for inoperable tumors, either as a standalone treatment or in combination with chemotherapy. A key advantage of this method over conventional radiotherapy is its ability to spare healthy liver tissues, which are highly sensitive to radiation, thereby minimizing adverse side effects. We selected a product with a 100-day time frame to enable faster commercialization and market readiness. Currently, our laboratory focuses on producing internal radiotherapy products, including brachytherapy techniques. These are targeted therapeutic methods capable of localized treatment of tumor tissues. Producing these devices positions us as a regional hub for advancing medical tourism. It is worth noting that our laboratory is the only active facility in the country and the broader region, excluding Russia, specializing in the production of medical radioactive sources. This grants us significant potential in medical tourism. The production of yttrium-90 glass microspheres has already been successfully implemented at the Nuclear Science and Technology Research Institute. The pilot-scale production stages are now complete. The animal phase has been completed, and all necessary tests, including toxicity, dimensional, and density tests, which are specific to the production process, have been conducted. The physical parameters of the product align with those of commercial sources, and from our perspective, this phase is fully accomplished. However, to enter the market, it was imperative to conduct the clinical phase to determine the product's efficacy. We are currently carrying out the clinical phase in collaboration with Shahid Beheshti, University of Medical Sciences. Approximately 20 patients have been treated with this product so far. Initial results reported by the treating physicians have been satisfactory, meeting the parameters we prioritize, such as absence of toxicity, no leakage to other organs, and concentration in liver tissue. These outcomes have been observed and documented in several early-stage treatment cases. Indeed, the preliminary results have been declared promising. These results may include reductions in tumor size, tumor necrosis, decreased vascularization, diminished blood supply to the tumor tissue, and I would like to highlight reduced metabolic activity within the tumor area. Fortunately, the outcomes thus far have been encouraging. God willing, upon completing the clinical phase and analyzing the results, we will proceed to secure the required permits from the Ministry of Health, Treatment, and Medical Education to introduce this product to the market and commence its commercial distribution.
We've come to the end of this episode of Iran Sec.
skies. See, a pure heart never lies. The words you learn will never earn. It's time to think and wonder why. Stars above will always be a shining guide for us to see. And when I doubt, I'll have no doubt, but still I wonder why. Digging through our pages past, wondering how the truth will last. God's in control is what I've found. I think I'll try this time around. And no one really feels the path I seek. And no one's gonna care as much as me. And no one seems to know our history. And stories are told for the world to see. And maybe I'll find the path I seek tonight. Let it be. Only God really knows what's right. Maybe I'll find the path I seek tonight. Let it be. Only God really knows I tried.
The heroes of our past unfold. Their glory is unique, we're told. The stories mark a precious past, but do we question why? A quest for truth can never be a lot I've faked inside of me. I walk in shoes I've never felt, only then I'll sure know why. They tell me, just make up your mind. The path I seek just needs a sign. The end is where I wanna be. Which way I go is up to me. And no one really feels the path I seek. And no one's gonna care as much as me. I know you cared as much as me. Our stories were shared for us to see. And perhaps it's best to part and be. And maybe we'll find the path we seek tonight. Let it be. Only God really knows what's right. Maybe.
Today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Salamu alaikum, dear brother and sister. Welcome. This is today's special from IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for choosing this program to listen to, where we're going to speak about living a blessed life.
Life is not the same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I? When I have you, to doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know, amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. You are the light.
darkest night. Shows me right from wrong and the world that often lies. Cause I don't need
Today is Wednesday, 19th of Jamadi Uthani, 1447 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar, corresponding to the 19th of the month of Azar, 1404 of the Islamic Solar Hijri calendar, and the 10th of December, 2025 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. We listen to one verse from the Holy Quran and the important point of it. For today, chapter Al-Imran, verse 160.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. In yansurkumullahu fala ghaliba lakum. Wa in yakhdhulkum faman dhalladhi yansurkum min ba'dih. وَعَلَى اللَّهِ فَلْيَتَوَكَّلِ الْمُؤْمِنُونَ.
If Allah should aid you, no one can overcome you. But if He should forsake you, who is there that can aid you after Him? And upon Allah, let the believers rely.
لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا اللَّهُ لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا اللَّهُ.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
In the previous verse, trust and reliance in Allah was recommended. In this verse, the reason of that reliance is expressed, saying that both honor and abasement are with Allah. It is narrated that Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his family asked Gabriel, "What is trust in Allah?" Gabriel answered, "It is so that you know people do not give you profit nor loss, neither they grant nor restrain, and that you be despair of all humankind. Then when a servant becomes like this, he will not act for anyone except Allah. He will not be hopeful of or afraid of anyone but Allah. He will not become desirous in anyone save Allah. And this is the reality of trust or tawakkul."
Shukran ya Rabbi, shukran.
شكراً يا ربي شكراً هديت قلبي شكراً نورت دربي شكراً شكراً يا رب يا منزل القرآن يا خالق الإنسان يا ربي يا رحمن شكراً يا.
We're going to speak about to live a blessed life. Be with us. We may think that the good life is a life devoid of any difficulties, a comfortable, luxurious life. On the contrary, those who enjoy the good life may experience some of the worst worldly difficulties. However, despite the difficulties and severe illnesses they may suffer, their hearts are at peace. Their hearts are content with Allah's decree. They may have very little material wealth, but their hearts are brimming with iman and the love of Allah. Our beloved Prophet is the person who best personified this. He owned very little of the world. He would sleep on a simple mat, which would leave marks on his blessed back. But despite this, he lived the best life. When he speaks, Prophet Muhammad speaks for Allah. When he is silent, he's silent for Allah. When he moves for Allah. When he's still for Allah.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Dear brothers and sisters, today we have another topic to discuss about. If life is a blessing, are we looking at the life as a blessing? The philosophy of religion asks whether life's value depends on a relationship to something beyond the world, such as God or transcendent good. Many religion philosophers argue that if humans are created with a purpose, then life is inherently precious, even when individuals cannot see the full picture. This view does not erase suffering, but situates it within a larger narrative of creation, fall, redemption, and hope. Such approaches often claim that human beings bear a special dignity, sometimes expressed in terms like image of God. If this is true, then every human life reflects, however imperfectly, something of divine wisdom, creativity, and love. Life is a blessing not only because of what people can do, but because of what they are in their deepest nature. In many strands of Christianity, life is explicitly described as a gift from Allah. Both in its physical and spiritual dimensions, God is seen as the author of life. So to receive life is to receive something willed, known, and loved by its giver. This is why concepts such as the sanctity of life are fundamental. Human lives have value in themselves, not merely because they are useful. This gift language extends beyond biological existence to include opportunities for growth in holiness, love, and communion with Allah and others. Salvation is something portrayed as the renewal of restoration of the human person to his or her intended likeness to Allah. Enabling a fullness of life that goes beyond survival in such a view, even temporal suffering can be woven into an eternal story in which life is ultimately fulfilled rather than extinguished.
Special topics for a special program. You can listen today, now and here, IRIB English Radio.
May this moment last forever in your hearts, a day you'll always remember every bar.
Today's a special.
This feeling of love, just let it grow forever through your life. Bring beautiful years of joy between you till the end of time.
When Allah, the most merciful and compassionate, created us, and all the creations in this world, we know and believe that He intends good for us. There is potential greatness and beauty of our creation that Allah even appoints us as the responsible authority on earth above other creations. Each one of us is created unique. We know that there is divine wisdom. This means that our creation is not without purpose. There is purpose in our lives. Life cannot be worthy when we don't live it. It is worth living, especially when we live with a moral compass that is set by the divine. Our religion facilitates us to live the best we can in this world and the next. One question will be raised here. What actions increase barakah in our life? One of the items is dua and dhikr. Dua or supplication is the essence of worship, and we should spend time every single day to call upon Allah with sincere, humble hearts, persistently asking for the best of this life and the next are many examples of what to ask for in terms of barakah, such as in one's time, health and wealth. Additionally, an example of barakah is starting many actions with Bismillah, that means in the name of Allah. Sincerely hoping for reward, blessings in the action and protection. Prayer or dua for barakah is also frequently used in Islam when it comes to wanting blessings for other people, such as when someone has a newborn and you pray for blessings in their child or blessings for those who get married as well as those who purchase new items, for example, houses, cars, or any other devices.
So, what is the good life here? If life is a blessing, then what is a good life from an Islamic perspective? The phrase Hayatan Tayyiba in Surah An-Nahl, verse 97, offers a clear explanation of this usage in the Quran. According to this verse, Allah grants a good and pleasant life to believers who perform righteous deeds. Commentators have contrasted this with an ma'ishatan banka, difficult life. And they believe this good life can occur in this world, in the barzakh, that is intermediate state, intermediary world, or in the hereafter. The commentators have also interpreted this good life as lawful sustenance, contentment, paradise, happiness, faith in Allah, performing acts of worship, experiencing the sweetness of obedience to Allah, attaining the ability to worship, independence from creation and turning to Allah Himself, and knowing Allah and being truthful before Him.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of today's special, which in that way speak about a blessed life and the ways, of course. Follow us. Thank you and fi amanillah.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Rabbi, Muhammad Nabi, Aliyul Imami, Lafata illa Ali, Aliyul Imami. علي إمامي علي إمامي
لا إله إلا الله الله ربي
محمد نبي علي إمامي
لا فتى إلا علي علي إمامي علي إمامي علي إمامي
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
May peace, blessings, and God's mercy be with you all. In November 2025, Iraq held its sixth parliamentary elections since the U.S.-led invasion in 2003. A total of 7,744 candidates from 31 electoral alliances competed for 329 seats for a four-year term. In these elections, several prominent Iraqi political forces presented their visions for governing the country and prioritizing reforms. Despite the differences in their rhetoric, most focused on shared concerns, such as building effective institutions, improving public services, and combating corruption. However, among the 31 alliances and approximately 7,744 candidates, hardly any addressed the issue of Iraqi sovereignty, which has been violated by the United States in their electoral platforms. Only a very small number of candidates, no more than a handful, mentioned this topic in scattered speeches, not in their platforms, referring to the sovereignty of a country that was invaded and besieged, where hundreds of thousands of citizens lost their lives. Following the 2003 invasion and the subsequent withdrawal in 2011, along with its return under the banner of the International Coalition in 2014, the United States has managed to exert systematic control over Iraq through a network of both visible and invisible pressure. This control is exercised through five key tools. 1. Monitoring financial flows by the U.S. Federal Reserves, effectively overseeing Iraq's dollar reserves and their overseas transfers. 2. Influence on security institutions through training programs and technical and technological support. 3. Indirect political influence by establishing relationships with influential forces in backing the so-called restructuring of the Iraqi state. 4. Influence in the oil sector, impacting contracts and terms set by American companies. 5. Military presence and threats, maintaining a military presence and making direct threats to security. For instance, the United States has imposed sanctions on Iraqi companies and individuals accused of collaborating with Iran or facilitating the evasion of American sanctions. Washington has also pressured successive Iraqi governments to sign large agreements with American companies in the energy, oil, technology, and health sectors, aiming to encircle Iraqi economic core and integrate it into the American system. The most alarming aspect is that the revenue from every barrel of oil sold by Iraq goes directly into an account at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, giving Washington control over the oil revenues that keep the Iraqi economy afloat. In the week leading up to the elections, specifically on November 6, 2025, a technical meeting took place between U.S. and Iraqi officials to discuss the features of the bilateral security relationship and the future of coalition forces in Iraq, namely the U.S. military presence, which is opposed by an Iraqi political force, highlighting the complexity of the issue. In 2020, the Iraqi parliament passed a law mandating the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Iraq, but this law has yet to be implemented. In June 2025, Iraqi airspace was completely violated by Israeli planes attacking Iran with direct support from the United States. Despite this incident, no party that participated in the parliamentary elections included an explicit clause regarding the presence of U.S. forces in Iraq. Similarly, no Iraqi bloc adopted a clause demanding the release of Iraqi funds from the control of the Federal Reserve in New York. In summary, despite a partial military withdrawal, Washington still maintains a comprehensive network of influence that spans finance, security, and international relations. This makes issues related to sovereignty sensitive or nearly impossible to raise in an electoral context. The shift in strategy from direct military means to a form of soft power while still keeping a usable military club when necessary has created a reality in Iraq where every political force is aware of the American red lines that cannot be crossed without significant costs. For this reason, it's not hard to see why blocs and candidates steer clear of discussing the issue of military presence and American financial dominance. This is mainly due to the fear of sanctions, financial embargoes, and the designation of factions as terrorist organizations, which could lead to direct military attacks. It's essential to remember that from 2019 to 2024, in the period following the defeat of Daesh and when the U.S. presence in Iraq was officially part of the coalition, Iraqi figures, factions, and official armed forces were subjected to declared U.S. strikes. These attacks were justified under the pretext of responding to the assault on the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad, late 2019, due to the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, commander of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps of Iran, and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, head of the Popular Mobilization Unit's General Staff, early 2020. On the grounds of retaliating for an operation carried out by Iraqi factions against the U.S. military base in Jordan, early 2024. The disdain for Iraqi money in New York stems from its role as one of the most dangerous tools of American influence. 90% of Iraq's dollar transactions go through a system overseen by the United States, and any misstep or deterioration in relations could disrupt foreign transfers, limit Iraqi banking activities, or freeze a portion of reserves, as was seen on a limited basis in 2022 and 2023. In summary, the United States exerts comprehensive hegemony over Iraq in military, political, economic, and financial aspects. The reasons preventing Iraqi political forces from addressing this hegemony are the same ones that compel them to raise the issue of these archives. It's illogical for their country to be subjected to such a high level of external threats, with the United States turning their country's airspace into a corridor for Israeli planes to attack a neighboring country, while this level of danger is ignored under the pretext of American threats. The lack of candidates willing to open these files demonstrates Iraq's current weakness in the face of Washington and reveals the fragility of its security and financial stability. The silence is not due to neutrality or a matter of choice. Rather, it is a silence imposed by the equations of power and American hegemony. In this episode, we will examine the American hegemony over Iraq, a dominance whose simplest consequence is the restructuring of the Iraqi political landscape, and whose most severe outcome is the neutralization of Iraq from the causes surrounding it, which are its own. This has turned Iraq, through the direct presence of American military forces, into a platform that threatens both its own people and the nations in the region. In Geneva, Switzerland, in 1991, the then U.S. Secretary of State James Baker delivered a powerful message to Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz. Iraq will be bombed and sent back to the Stone Age. 12 years later, Baker's prophecy came true. The United States invaded Iraq following a comprehensive embargo that plunged the country into hunger, led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, and stripped them of their most basic human rights. While some may argue that Saddam's invasion of Kuwait justified the embargo and subsequent intervention, there are deeper reasons that warrant a thorough analysis. Italian sociologist and economic theorist Giovanni Arrighi argues that the 2003 invasion and occupation of Iraq was not merely a strategic blunder by the United States, but rather a historic turning point in the cycle of modern capitalism. According to Arrighi, Iraq signified the end of a U.S. hegemonic cycle that began in 1945. This introduction is essential for understanding the significance of Iraq, its geopolitical relevance, and the capitalist and imperialist perspectives on the country. Arrighi categorizes the history of capitalism into four cycles of hegemony: Genoese, Dutch, British, and American. In each cycle, the dominant power progresses through a series of phases. First, a phase of productive expansion. Second, a phase of financial expansion. Third, a crisis. Fourth, a war or military intervention aimed at preserving its hegemony. And fifth, a collapse. Arighi argues that the United States entered a phase of financial crisis and debt in the 1970s when it lost its productive edge over East Asian countries. To safeguard its financial position, it turned to its military power, and Iraq became the perfect stage to reaffirm its hegemony through force. Why Iraq? Because according to Arighi, it was at the heart of the world's oil reserves, represented the central axis of the dollar-based financial system, and was geopolitically strategic for containing China's expansion and exerting pressure on Europe and Russia in the energy sector. Arighi states that the wars fought by empires during their periods of weakness hastened their downfall, just as the Boer War, which occurred in South Africa in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, signaled the beginning of the end for the British Empire. Similarly, the war in Iraq, according to his theory, marked the onset of the decline of American supremacy. Arighi believes that Washington's focus on Iraq and Afghanistan has allowed China to broaden its economic influence in Asia and Africa, forming energy alliances that attract industries and develop competitive infrastructures. In his view, China's achievements represent a structural revolution in the global economy. Arighi sees the U.S. occupation of Iraq as part of the evolution of global capitalism and its efforts to overcome its crisis. The Arab thinker Edward Said, although he did not live to see all the consequences of the invasion and occupation, interpreted the events in Iraq since 1991 as part of the structure of Orientalist discourse. Said criticized the use of phrases like existential threat or a regime that only responds to force, which were used to construct a media narrative that justified the war, portraying Iraq not as it was, but as the United States needed it to be perceived. Additionally, in 2012, researcher and writer Christopher Doran published a study titled How Iraq Threatened the U.S. Economic Empire and Had to Be Destroyed, which largely aligns with Arighi's theory. Doran draws a historical parallel from April 1917, when U.S. President Woodrow Wilson justified America's entry into World War I with the argument of making the world safe for democracy. However, Wilson's true motivation was to safeguard American corporate investments in Britain and France, ensuring that bankers like J.P. Morgan would recover the loans extended to these nations. From this viewpoint, World War I was fundamentally a war aimed at bolstering the security of capitalism. According to Doran, the same reasoning applies to Iraq after 1991. The suffering of the Iraqi people began with Saddam Hussein's war against Iran, followed by his invasion of Kuwait. The suffering was exacerbated during the sanctions period from 1990 to 2003 and escalated dramatically with the American invasion and occupation that is after 2003. Under the guise of a comprehensive economic reform, the United States aimed to establish the first neoliberal free market economy in West Asia, intending to monopolize the country's economic resources and investment opportunities for itself and its allies at the expense of the Iraqi people, their services, social welfare, and humanitarian needs. In the decades leading up to the suffering, Iraq stood in stark contrast to the neoliberal ideology and the model proposed by the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. Iraq was a significant oil-producing nation and benefited from market manipulation and oil price increases in 1973 and beyond. However, unlike Saudi Arabia, Iraq refused to send its oil profits to the United States in exchange for protection. Instead, it invested its oil revenues in development and encouraged other Arab oil-producing countries to follow suit. Doran states in his study, following the overthrow of the monarchy in 1958 and prior to the economic sanctions, Iraq was a nation focused on two main issues, development and Arab nationalism. This country had all the necessary elements to evolve into a developed nation like those in the global north. Iraq had a skilled workforce, an industrial base, education, health care, a strong infrastructure, abundant resources, an educated middle class, and an effective state apparatus. Joint Arab economic reports published by the Arab Monetary Fund over the years confirm that between 1958 and 1978, development indicators in Iraq showed faster than usual improvements in health, education, and social conditions. Furthermore, Iraq demonstrated a remarkable ability to reduce income disparities among its population. After Saddam's war against Iran and the invasion of Kuwait, the 1991 war devastated the country's infrastructure. Sanctions from 1990 to 2003 and Western aggression destroyed Iraqi society. The U.S. invasion in 2003 dismantled the state itself, turning the country into a scene of violence and collapse. Today, in 2025, 22 years after the invasion, the overthrow of Saddam and the lifting of sanctions, Iraq's electricity crisis continues. According to Christopher Duran, in the year 2000, Iraq directly challenged one of the foundations of American global dominance by refusing to accept dollars. This move made a military response from the United States unavoidable. One of the most crucial elements of the global economy and U.S. hegemony was the petrodollar, the requirement that oil, the world's most vital commodity, be sold exclusively in dollars. Following the invasion in June 2003, the U.S. military occupation resumed the sale of Iraqi oil in dollars. This military invasion followed the United States not only to take control of Iraqi oil, but also to ensure the continuation of the neoliberal agenda, dismantling the state, minimizing the role of government, and privatizing public services. These are core principles of neoliberalism. In a similar vein, and placing the war against Iraq within the framework of the global capitalist crisis, American Marxist thinker and political theorist David North published an article in 2010 titled "The Crisis of American Capitalism and the War Against Iraq." North argues that Saddam's regime was, in part, a byproduct of the bloody U.S. interventions during the 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s, which aimed to eliminate the socialist labor movement in West Asia, a significant political force in the region. The question of the United States' role in the rise of Ba'athists in Iraq is debatable, particularly regarding the coup on February 8, 1963, which overthrew the nationalist and leftist regime of Abdul Karim Qasim and brought the Ba'athists to power with CIA support. However, David North contends that the primary goal of the United States was to control Iraq's oil reserves. He adds that all attempts to deny the crucial role of oil in the U.S. efforts to invade Iraq reek of falsehood and absurdity. No other natural resource has influenced U.S. imperialist political and economic calculations in the past century as much as oil and natural gas. When discussing oil, it's important to highlight that Central America's interest in crude is not just about ensuring profits for the massive U.S. oil companies, the U.S. industry, the stability of its financial structure, and its dominant global position rely on unrestricted access and control over the vast oil resources of the Persian Gulf and, more recently, the Caspian Sea Basin. According to North, the history of U.S. foreign policy and military strategy before 2010 can be examined from a purely economic viewpoint as a response to the oil crisis of 1973, which occurred after the conflict between the Israeli occupying entity and Egypt, Syria, along with several supporting Arab states. North argues that this event had a significant impact on the U.S. economy and the global capitalist economy. The second oil crisis following the Iranian Revolution of 1979 led to the Carter Doctrine, which stated that unrestricted access to the Persian Gulf was a vital strategic concern for the United States. This, in turn, paved the way for the large-scale deployment of U.S. military forces in our region.
Hello,
The straightforward historical explanation, which places the war against Iraq in its economic context, brings us to the present day, where the United States continues to control Iraqi resources and plays a crucial role in the balance of power and wealth distribution in the region. In an article titled Eight Reasons Why the United States and Iraq Still Need Each Other, published by David Pollack on the Washington Institute's website in 2020, two key points were identified that highlight the economic interests of the United States in Iraq and justify its ongoing presence. One, the energy and financial value. Pollack stated that in addition to Iraq's geostrategic and political value, the country is now one of the largest oil exporters in the world, with vast long-term reserves. He argued that if the U.S. presence remains as it is, the economies of the United States, Iraq, and the global economy will collectively benefit from these resources. As was his custom before his death in 2024, Pollack used the Iranian spectrum to justify the ongoing U.S. occupation of Iraq. He argued that if the United States withdrew, Iran would effectively increase its control over Iraq's vast energy and financial resources, hindering their use in Iraqi development projects to evade sanctions and promote its hegemonic ambitions. Two, Iraq as a regional counterbalance. The second point he raised also fits within the same context, stating that the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council countries were expected to start supplying electricity to Iraq in 2020 to lessen its independence on Iranian supply. According to Pollack, if the United States continued to be involved in the events, Iraq could shift from being a threat to becoming a partner with other Arab allies in the region. However, if the United States withdrew, some governments of the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council and their populations might view Iraq as an even more subordinate state to Iran, either due to its Shiite majority or the departure of the main counterbalancing power. Furthermore, these governments' willingness to rely on the already questionable American guarantees would diminish even more after the withdrawal. All of this would increase the pressure on the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council countries to appease Iran, thus snatching a U.S. defeat from the jaws of victory. It's important to emphasize that although Pollack was an outspoken Zionist, his arguments reflect the true mindset of the U.S. administration and institutions to maintain their military presence in Iraq even under the guise of containing Iran. What has been presented so far illustrates the centrality of Iraq and its oil to the global capitalist system and specifically to U.S. hegemony over our country and the world. It's worth noting that since the 2003 invasion, the United States has exerted dominant control over the Iraqi oil sector. Four American companies, Coastal, Phoenix, Chevron, and Mobil, have taken on the management, investment, and marketing of a significant portion of the country's oil wealth. Many of the signed agreements have been illegal and unconstitutional. A recent example occurred in May 2025, when the Iraqi Kurdistan region announced contracts worth $110 billion with the American companies HKN Energy and Western Zagros, despite the opposition from the Ministry of Oil in Baghdad, which declared them invalid. The ministry reminded that natural resources belong to all Iraqis and that any investment agreement must be managed through the federal government in Baghdad, in accordance with the law and the Constitution. On that day, in a speech delivered in Washington, Masoud Barzani, the Prime Minister of the Iraqi Kurdistan region, announced these agreements in a context where the United States supported the supply of oil and energy in the Kurdistan region. Meanwhile, Washington was preventing Baghdad from importing energy from Iran, citing compliance with sanctions. The United States refused to renew a waiver that allowed Iraq to purchase Iranian electricity without facing repercussions. This issue was also used as a pressure tool before the Iraqi parliamentary elections of 2025, aiming to facilitate foreign companies' control over the Iraqi electricity sector. The oil sector is the clearest evidence of U.S. dominance over Iraq, but another equally important aspect is the financial sector and the control of the dollar. Since 2003, Washington has been managing Iraq's oil export revenues by keeping these funds, the proceeds from oil sales, in accounts at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. It's essential to remember that UN Security Council Resolution 1483 from 2003 mandated that revenues from Iraqi oil and gas exports be deposited into a special account known as the Development Fund for Iraq. A significant portion of this fund was allocated to pay $53 billion to Kuwait as compensation for the losses incurred during the war imposed by Saddam. It's important to highlight that the UN Security Council Resolution 1483 did not mention the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States as the custodian of these funds. However, Iraqi oil revenues are directly deposited into this account in New York. As of today, December 2025, Iraq continues to face restrictions on these funds, sometimes under the guise of combating terrorism and money laundering, and at other times under the pretext of protecting Iraq itself from lawsuits filed against it since the 1990s. In summary, the United States uses this fund, which is held in a New York bank, to manage Iraqi funds, oversee their usage, and employ them for political blackmail. It's important to note that despite this stringent American oversight, Iraq continues to be linked with corruption and embezzlement. This raises a crucial question. How is it possible that under such strict financial control, Iraqi officials managed to smuggle millions, even billions of dollars, out of the country? Beyond this contradiction, Iraq's financial situation today, in December 2025, remains questionable. Despite the accumulation of oil revenues in the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, which has reached $120 billion, Iraq faces a growing debt equivalent to the same amount, over $100 billion. Iraq's inability to manage its own finances hinders reconstruction and long-term development, forcing successive Iraqi governments to rely on international loans. Ironically, Iraq has also become one of the largest holders of U.S. Treasury bonds, with a total value reaching $41 billion in 2023. This means that instead of investing its money in profitable businesses or internal development projects, Iraq purchased U.S. bonds, effectively lending $41 billion to the United States. This investment in bonds does not yield high returns that the Iraqi people could have achieved if their government had invested these funds in productive sectors or large tech companies. To further illustrate the ability of the United States to influence Iraqi decision-making, it's important to note that in July 2024, the Central Bank of Iraq halted all foreign transactions in Chinese currency due to pressure from the U.S. Federal Reserve. This action was taken because the United States viewed payments in currencies other than the dollar as a threat to its financial dominance. Additionally, as part of its strategy to exert financial pressure on Baghdad, the United States prevented Iraq from passing a new law to regulate the popular mobilization units, PMU. This obstruction was achieved through political means and the threat of financial sanctions by refusing to pay the salaries of PMU members. In this way, the United States was able to impose its will on the Iraqis quite easily. على العراقيين